when I started telling people that I was interested in group creativity, they told me it was an oxymoron. And I said, but what about bands? What about theater? What about R&D labs? And it was fascinating to see that sort of resistance and to see a phenomenon that was out there, but nope, not looking at it.
Welcome to Talking Creativity, the Crania podcast from Dublin City University. I'm Ciarán Dunn.
I'm Joe Binetti.
And I'm Tim Hannigan. In this series, we talk to academic experts on creativity, creative practitioners, people from the creative industries and the arts, and those working across disciplines and at the boundaries between scholarship and practice.
The aim of these conversations is to dig into creativity, to figure out what it means, and above all, to explore ways to encourage it in any field or discipline.
The Crania Project is based at Dublin City University and funded by the National Forum for the Enhancement of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education. In this episode, we're joined by Alfonso Monturi. Alfonso is professor in the Transformative Inquiry Department at the California Institute of Integral Studies. He's a scholar across multiple domains, including creativity and improvisation, the epistemology of complexity and systems thinking, transdisciplinarity, social change, and indeed education. He's widely published in the area of creativity, and his work has been translated into Italian, French, Spanish, and Chinese. Alfonso is passionate about the importance of creativity, its relationship with diversity, and the need for it in what he refers to as post-normal times. Alfonso is also an accomplished musician, having recorded as a saxophonist with recording artists from around the world.
So, Alfonso, thanks enormously for being a guest on the Crania podcast for this episode. I'm absolutely delighted to have you. I've been a big fan of your work and your ideas and your thoughts over the years. So it's a pleasure to finally talk to you directly.
Thank you. So it's a pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to this.
Excellent. So just to begin with, perhaps you might give our listeners a bit of background about yourself.
Yeah. It's always a bit of a story because my parents were diplomats. So my father was Italian and my mother was Dutch, which always created interesting situations, of course, with football. Because coincidentally, you know, my team Ajax happened to be playing Italian teams in the European Cup final in the 70s. So that was already a culture clash there. And so, yeah, so we lived, I lived in Holland for a little bit, then Beirut, and then Athens, and then moved to London when I was 12, and hated school, and really wanted to play in a band, and that's what I did most of the time. And then when my last band broke up, decided to move to sunny California, because a lot of the writers that I was interested in and a lot of the music that I was interested in seemed to be coming from California. So I thought, let me go check that promised land out. And then I ended up in Northern California in the Bay Area, and except for a brief year in China in 85, 86, that's where I've been ever since.
Brilliant. And in terms of it, let's say your academic interest in creativity, or, you know, ideological and philosophical interest in creativity, how did that emerge?
That was also sort of a strange route in a way. I mean, one of the obvious ones was just playing in a band. And so I was interested in creativity, although I didn't refer to it as creativity at the time, but obviously how can we do something great, right? But my academic interest in creativity really came about because I'd moved to the US and I wanted to study authoritarianism and racism and prejudice, coming out of London in the 70s and early 80s with the British movement, the National Front, a lot of things going on there, and just my own experience as somebody who never lived in the country that issued his passport, right? I mean, I never lived in Italy, although I was technically an Italian citizen. I was interested in prejudice and the way that people would talk about other countries. And in the 70s, it was okay to make disparaging remarks about other countries in ways that it really isn't these days. And so I was interested in that, and I came, you know, I was reading The Authoritarian Personality, the classic research, and just by accident bumped into Frank Baron, who was a well-known creativity researcher, and I read his book on the creative personality and compared the characteristics of the creative person to those of the authoritarian person. And I realized that they were exact opposites. And I thought, well, how can we look at creativity not just as something wonderful in the arts and the sciences, but also as a way of being in the world that's more about connecting and creating rather than sort of eliminating what we don't want, the whether it's the foreigners or the this or the that. And that has stayed with me. And it was also sort of happening in London in a way, because on the one, obviously in the 70s with unemployment and all that sort of thing, you had a lot of young men who didn't have a lot to do and weren't very happy. And so I could see how they were easily brought into the National Front, the British movement, all these organizations. And yet at the same time, there was the two-tone movement, which was celebrating diversity, which was celebrating creativity. And that's what I was drawn to. And it was sort of that creativity and authoritarianism dichotomy there that was very inspirational for me. And I've sort of been following that ever since, in a way.
That's a really left field dichotomy. It's not an obvious one you would think of, but I suppose that leads us on to what's always our formal opening question in these discussions, which is around, you know, from your perspective, what one word do you associate with the concept of creativity and why that would be the case?
Well, I think for me, it would have to be passion in a way, because as a boy, I was passionate about music and I was passionate about reading and ideas and sort of trying to make sense of the world. And yet at school, there was no hint of passion. I was terrible at school, high school, even undergrad, I was just really not very good. And it wasn't until I got to the US and went to graduate school that I really started enjoying it and getting in touch with that passion for ideas and so on. Because I think partly because I was just such a mutt, you know, living in different countries, I was kind of trying to make sense of all the complexities of people living in different countries and how they would sort of create different realities and assume that this is reality, right? And then you'd go somewhere else, go see my grandparents in Holland or something, and they would live in a different reality than my grandparents in Italy, and have things that were given that were not given in another country. And so I was trying to make sense of all that. And I sort of ended up seeing that as a creative process, if you will.
So that phenomenon of being a third culture kid, you know, who's kind of like a cultural nomad in many ways. And it has, I know Barack Obama has spoken himself about, you know, to a certain extent being a third culture kid. It obviously comes with certain challenges. But do you feel that kind of experience of diversity, the recognition of multiple valid realities is an important variable in being creative or fostering creativity?
I think it was for me. Yeah, I definitely think it was for me. And I think even if you don't live in a lot of different countries, I think, you know, depending on where you live, but really these days we have the opportunity to be exposed to so many different cultures, and we can learn from them and dive into them. And you know, one of the great ways of doing it, of course, is to go out with somebody from a different culture, which inevitably will bring you a lot closer. But I do think it's related to creativity, and there's research showing the relationship between experiences in other countries and creativity and sort of a multiplicity of perspectives and that kind of thing. Yeah.
When you mentioned this idea of passion as your kind of entry point into discussions around creativity, I would take that from my perspective of understanding a lot to do with intrinsic motivation. So I'm rarely passionate about something that someone else kind of foists upon me, that I tend to get passionate about. You know, it's intrinsic motivation. And for me, or it seems to me, it can be very challenging to try and stoke intrinsic motivation in other people. Do you have any advice on that or experience around what's the best way to try and stoke that intrinsic motivation, if indeed passion is the key element of creativity?
Yeah, I mean, I work with doctoral students a lot, and one of the interesting things that happens when they have to start thinking about their dissertation topic is we spend quite a bit of time with them and dialogue with them, and you see that there are often sort of layers of in terms of what they think they should be doing in the beginning, right? Which is, well, I'll do this because it'll help me get a job or whatever, right? So there are these layers of assumptions and shoulds, and underneath it very often there is, well, you know, if I really wanted to do something that I'm really passionate about, I would do this. And that often comes up after a considerable amount of talk and discussion. So I think it takes a while for us to get in touch often with what we're really passionate about, or the possibility that we can actually work on it, you know? And so there's both the topic and the process. I think certainly if you end up going into a doctoral program, I think you have to have passion for the actual process of research and inquiry and finding things out. But I think with kids, I mean, I remember I was very fortunate in primary school. I had a great teacher who just turned the whole process of finding things out into something linked to a joyful experience. And that really was very formative for me. But then, of course, it also ensured that I would be disappointed with most of my other educational experiences, because he could make the driest, allegedly driest and dullest topics into things that you enjoyed exploring. And he had a real sort of magic touch there. But I thought, well, it's possible, damn it. So why not?
And is it the case, though, clearly in that example, it's an individual, you know, who had this ability to nurture and to stimulate creativity. Have you noticed, because as you were saying, you travel around a lot, and you've experienced the different systems, would you have noticed that certain educational systems give more priority, give more attention, value creativity more than others in how they are rolled out, how they operate?
Yeah. I mean, one of the disappointing things that's happening now is I'm seeing in the US, I'm seeing that more and more education is just focused on, you know, what I call reproductive education, which is just getting the right answer and making sure you pass the test. It just becomes very instrumental and I think authoritarian too in that sense. So I think it's possible to create these kinds of environments, unfortunately, we're moving away from it. I think in the 60s, there was sort of this trend for alternative education. And I think it sort of went over the edge a little bit because you had faculty who had gone through sort of the rigors of traditional systems and in a way were allowing their students to have all the fun that they didn't have, but they forgot that they themselves had actually done a lot of the hard work. And so students would come out of those programs having had a wonderful time, but lacking some of the basics. I think that was one of the problems that was happening. And I think of it in musical terms. I mean, I think it's wonderful if you know, go to music camp and you have a great time, but if we want to play in a band together, you have to be able to play your instrument and you have to listen and you have to, there are certain skills that are necessary, right?
For sure. And so as regards, because, you know, I've been noticing there's a lot of narrative around, you know, the idea of assessing creativity and almost like the quantification of creative competence or capacity. And where do you stand on that? Is it a perhaps a flawed yet noble pursuit? Is it a dangerous pursuit? Is it a contradictory pursuit?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm crazy about the idea of assessing creativity. I mean, I think one of the things that sort of shocked me at a certain point was, you know, the PhD dissertation is supposed to be an original contribution to your field. But my experience was that I hadn't seen any universities that really sort of said, okay, well, if that's the case, then let's talk about creativity. Let's talk about, you know, let's look at some of these original contributions. Let's look at the creative process. Because originally creativity was seen as this sort of thing that was too subjective and couldn't really be articulated in any kind of systematic way. You know, the Romantics owned creativity, right? On the one hand, you had the scientists, and then you had the, and that was their thing. And who knows when ideas will come? But it's definitely the case that you can create an environment that fosters creativity. And what I prefer to do is to sort of open up a dialogue, because very often I notice that students do not associate academic work with creativity. It's like they seem like completely different worlds to them, right? Creativity is the arts and this and Einstein, right? That's sure, but not with the academic work that I'm doing in the classroom. So there are a lot of assumptions about creativity that I think need to be addressed. And also they struggle to understand, well, what is an original contribution to your field? Name some. Right. And I see that they struggle because they don't really think of them as original or creative. They sort of assume that somehow through the scientific method, there's an approach that will inevitably get you there. Right. But we know that's not the case. And so there's a lot of sort of addressing of fundamental assumptions that get in the way of creativity, I think, at this point. And I'd rather focus on that than sort of assessing. I mean, I know there are ways to assess creativity, but at the same time, I think in order to actually get something to happen, to be helpful to students, rather than assess creativity, I'd rather help them sort of think through their own kind of limiting assumptions about creativity and look at any institutional ways that creativity is prevented, right? Because education was never meant to be creative, right?
I think we're really getting to the crux of the matter around looking at kind of environmental factors that might either foster or hinder creativity. So what you're saying is, I mean, one of them is this idea of challenging limiting assumptions relating to perhaps a discipline or an idea. What other, from your experience, what other types of conditions, environmental conditions, do we need to foster, or values do we need to foster in education to at least endeavor to allow people to fulfill their or realize their creative potential?
Well, I think there are any number of them. My sense is that one of the things that's important is also to look at creativity relationally. So how can our relationships in the classroom inhibit or support creativity? Because I think there's inevitably a certain amount of risk taking that's involved. There's people speculate. People are open to the possibility of things that haven't been thought before. And of course, it's easy to dismiss ideas and just, oh, well, that's silly. And that inhibits us. And then we're likely not to come up with our next idea if we feel that by speaking up, we're just going to be dismissed or people are going to think we're weird. And, you know, especially when you're at a certain age, you don't want that to happen, right? You want to belong more. But we can also create environments where we know how to nurture ideas a little bit. That doesn't mean we have to accept them unconditionally and never look at them critically. But you know how it is. Ideas emerge and they need a little bit of time for us to play with them and explore them. And we don't teach that. We teach people how to be critical. Very often, I think in academia, you know, you show off how smart you are by critiquing somebody else's idea, right? Because that's where you show your how sharp you are. There's also a dimension where we need to be able to support each other in the way that musicians do. You know, if I'm playing the saxophone, the piano player is trying to make me sound good, right? And so I think we need to be able to learn that. It's not to say not be critical, but we need to be able to do both. Eventually, we need to be able to look at the idea critically, but we need to be able to generate together and be playful together.
I think that idea of demonstrating our own capacity, intellectual or otherwise, by pointing out, you know, cracks in other people's arguments is perhaps disproportionately common in academia. You know, so the idea of a critique as opposed to encouraging people to generate their own outputs and then, okay, put them out for other people to critique in turn. But I think, yeah, that kind of, perhaps we need to recalibrate, or do you think we need to recalibrate that balance between, you know, critique and production?
I think definitely. I've seen a lot of academic environments and just academics talking where it's very much about showing how clever you are because you can shoot down somebody else's idea. And again, I always have to say this because it's so easy to assume that, well, he's against, you know, critical thought. He just wants this creativity stuff. But the point is, you've got to have both. Even in the creative process, you have divergence and then you have convergence. And I think partly that also has to do with sort of the image of what an academic, what a scholar is, right? I know a lot of my students think of sort of the traditional image of the academic as sort of stuffy and, you know, pedantic and nitpicking, and they don't necessarily associate it with creativity unless you happen to be in physics, right? That's the place, you know, if you're doing quantum physics or Einstein, you know, then you're great, but then you can be creative. But all the other stuff, it's I think we need to revive and create images of people doing our kind of work that are more appealing and more and not just this sort of nitpicking kind of critical, you know, I'm looking over your shoulder and I'm gonna, you know, give you a grade. It's like, that's part of it, sure, but there's a lot more to it, and it's why a lot of us got into it, right? I mean, we didn't get into this to make a lot of money, right? I mean, we're into it. So I think that has to, that enjoyment. And also, we do also have dialogues and experiences with colleagues that are great, you know? And I think that needs to be, made visible, I think, to students and others, so they get a sense of it, you know? I mean, because I've said about the tendency to critique, but we've all had late night discussions with colleagues where we're just, you know, playing with ideas, and that's one of the reasons why we're into this, right? Because it's exciting, and projects can emerge, and I think that needs to be also highlighted more in what it is that we do, don't you think?
Yeah, so I'm minded by, you know, the language you've been using around like images and visible and highlighted, and I'm reminded of one of my favorite terms that you use in one of your publications around these attractor images, almost like we need to role model specific behaviors so that others whom we want to cultivate those behaviors in can see them happening in a very kind of visible, meaningful way. So is that what you, so do you mean as educators, we need to show that where our enjoyment, our playfulness, our passion around our subject beyond our level of expertise of the curriculum, of the knowledge?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, there's the context of justification, right? Which is the paper that I've presented, and here it is, and I'm trying to make sure that it's, you know, all the ideas are supported and so on. But then there's the context of discovery. Is like, how did you get there? Well, normally we only get that if we're lucky to read a biography or an autobiography of some scholar, and we get to find out what was happening under the hood, right? And I think that needs to be a bigger part of education. That's why I encourage people to write autobiographical pieces. I mean, I have this book of autobiographical essays by people who are into systems and complexity theories, because I found that students can look at it and get a little put off. It's like, oh my God, this is going to be very heady. But I want them to understand, well, why did these people get into this, right? What were they doing that made them think, you know, I need another perspective, or I saw that, you know, and it motivated me to engage in this other approach. So I think we need to have more of a sense of how people how people's lives are part of this whole experience and not just their finished product, right? How did you get into this? Why do you care about this stuff, right?
Is what you're talking about this idea of empathy, and, you know, that empathy is feeds into the creative process, and so far as you're not just creating for yourself, but you're also mindful of an environment and stakeholders within an environment, and that they may have different perspectives.
Yeah. I mean, I think I mean that's certainly with my students. I mean, I know that if they're just writing their papers as if they're writing them for me, it's limited. I mean, I want them to think, well, what if you were writing to the larger community? I mean, one of the things that I have students do is write book reviews. And I always tell them, you know, if you write a book review by an author in your field, there's a pretty good chance that that author is going to read your review. And all of a sudden, they're going to know who you are, and you're going to be part of that world. And when that happens, it can often be sort of a shocking experience for them to realize that they're actually suddenly involved in a community, and they're not just writing papers for their instructor, right?
For sure. So they're developing almost this kind of level of social capital, part of a community.
Exactly. Yeah.
And in your institution, or in your at a national level, in terms of promoting interdisciplinarity, because let's say we know that creativity tends to emerge at the nexus, the intersection of diverse knowledge sets, when people, you know, think, oh, I didn't think of putting those two things together before in a novel and valuable way. Is there Is there a culture of promoting interdisciplinarity in your institution, or let's say in American education in general? Or do you think more needs to be done around that?
Well, there certainly is in my program. The doctoral program that we have is an explicitly transdisciplinary doctoral program. And so there's a course on transdisciplinarity, and they really get to think about it. And the interesting thing is that I find that most of the students want to cross disciplines anyway. Sort of these days, that's kind of where they're naturally coming from. So yes, in our program, it's explicit, and I think my university has sort of started using the term transdisciplinarity in some of the ways it defines itself. I mean, I think there's still resistance to crossing disciplines, because in the larger the sort of national discourse, because, you know, people create their worlds, and it's related to funding, to grants. And also, if I'm an expert in my field, the minute I start going transdisciplinary or interdisciplinary, I'm not the expert anymore, right? And I think for a certain kind of a person who is interested in, you know, the everything that comes with being an expert, that's not entirely appealing necessarily, right? So it creates this new need for a sort of for an intellectual humility, and so I'm interested in how we deal with that. Because it also opens up the possibility for more creativity, right? Because we're seeing things, we're trying to actually let go of some of our assumptions or some of the frameworks that we sort of use as a default.
It sounds like the idea of you know, suspending kind of a protectionism around our discipline, and perhaps even parking our egos a bit as well. And being open-minded and curious around, you know, the limitations of our knowledge. And in your institution, would you have like explicit modules or courses on creativity, or would the concept of creativity be woven across the fabric of programs, or how is it discussed?
In my department, in the doctoral program, we have a course on creative inquiry and we have a course on transdisciplinarity. And it's fascinating. I mean, doing this for so long, I find that I still have so much to learn about how to get these ideas across. And in 25 years, I've seen a change, in the sense that, you know, we tend to be seen as sort of an alternative institution, and students used to come for the alternative part, and kind of defined that then in opposition to what they thought was the traditional boring, you know, scholarly stuff, right? But now there's a change, because I think the American educational system has become so focused on, you know, no child left behind, but really this sort of reproductive mentality. I mean, one student, brilliant student in a course I was teaching just this semester, he said, well, you know, in the beginning, I thought you were, and he used a word that is a little livelier, shall we say, but I thought you were messing around with us. We didn't think you were serious about sort of the degree of openness and exploration that you wanted us to engage in, because they're used to having everything so scheduled and worked out that they were a little shocked. I said, well, he can't be serious, or maybe this is just a thing he's doing for 10 minutes or something. So it was fascinating.
And can you tell me a bit about the genesis of your particular organization and the ethos around it, and what, you know, did it emerge in a response to, you know, a conservative model, or did it identify a gap in the education system?
Well, the university itself has a very Californian history. I think it's now 50 years old. And it was started by people like Alan Watts. And sort of a mixture of people who were interested in East-West relations. Obviously, being on the West Coast, there's trade, but there's also this influence of Eastern thinkers that was becoming apparent 50 years ago or so. And Alan Watts was one of the great popularizers of Zen and Taoism and so on. And so the idea, originally it was the California Institute of Asian Studies. And then it became integral because a man from India was our first president, Haridas Chowdhury, and he was a student of Sri Aurobindo, who was both a mystic and sort of a social activist in India and involved in Indian independence. And so it brought these different elements together. And after it became the California Institute of Integral Studies, it sort of, you know, now we have philosophy programs and anthropology programs and a lot of psychotherapy programs and that kind of, so it's sort of broad, but every one of them is sort of influenced by different, it's in the sense non-traditional in that it brings in elements from different disciplines and different perspectives and so on. Although now, you know, the whole thing, meditation and so on, that was maybe still 20 years ago, still unusual. I mean, now there, you go to Harvard or many of the mainstream universities, they're talking about all that stuff. So
yeah, mindfulness has become very much very normalized. And this idea of you were saying that you're on the doctoral program, your students do a course on transdisciplinarity. Can you just tell me a bit about what that would involve, what content might be in that type of program?
It's interesting because when I first started teaching that in 95, there really wasn't very much out there about transdisciplinarity. Now there are schools of transdisciplinarity. There's the Zurich School and there's, you know, this, so there are different approaches because I think there's a sense that, you know, people talk about wicked problems, right? Wicked problems are problems that don't fit into a discipline. But then for me, creativity didn't fit into what I call the dominant disciplinary discourse, or basically where most of the work was being done, which was psychology. But I played in a band and I looked for, well, what do they have to say about bands? And nothing. I mean, that was shocking to me that you know, in the 80s, I looked around, there was nothing about creativity in groups, in bands, you know? And sort of that brought me into this whole issue of looking at, well, how do we construct topics? And you know, creativity was very much an American subject, right? And Americans are individualists. And so for Americans, the unit of analysis was the individual, is the genius, right? Not the group. And when I started telling people that I was interested in group creativity, they told me it was an oxymoron. And I said, but what about bands? What about theater? What about R&D labs? And it was fascinating to see that sort of resistance and to see a phenomenon that was out there, but nope, not looking at it.
That's fascinating how kind of dominant national cultural values can shape and color perspectives on things like, on phenomena like creativity. The idea that it's exclusively an individual activity or manifestation, when in reality it's based upon, you know, the interaction of lots of different variables.
Right. And just the creativity research was sort of summarized as PPP. So it was person, process, product, and press being sort of the environment. And nobody really paid much attention to that until recently. But just the fact that the who of creativity was the person. That was just given. It wasn't the relationship. It wasn't the group. It wasn't the environment. And there was this assumption that genius will come through no matter what. the circumstances, right? And so then conveniently, since all the geniuses, most of them that were recognized were white men, is that, well, obviously we're doing really well, aren't we? Right? Then we must just be more creative, you know? And hence Isaac even said, well, genius is you know, confined to men, basically, he was saying, you know, not women. It's just, right? And so all these fascinating assumptions were emerging from all of that. And I thought, I really need to look into this, because it's, again, everything was interconnected, right? Assumptions about gender, assumptions about race, assumptions about, you know, what the unit of analysis is. So for me, it became fascinating. There was just so much to explore, right? About how we had created creativity.
Yeah, and how the boundaries we had put on it and the characteristics we'd ascribed to it. And we've noticed, I mean, over the course of many different interviews we've done with experts all around the world, in different domains, the idea of gender has increasingly emerged, and it certainly does seem that there's a disproportionate dominance of white males who talk about creativity. There's a definite lack of attention given to females or the contribution of females in the field of creativity. And it might seem oxymoronic that, you know, us two as males are discussing it, but where do you think that comes from, this idea, you know, that the lack of attention afforded to female creativity? Or is it that just from a very young age, they're not, you know, females, girls aren't encouraged, or their own belief in their ability to be creative isn't encouraged?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot going on there, because, I mean, even in medicine, I mean, you see that a lot of drugs are tested on men, and they're not tested on women. And you know, the whole notion of, you know, the ascent of man, right? I mean, man was used as a term, but the truth is, not a lot of women in that great Bronowski documentary, right? So I think it was a combination of factors. Because it was also sort of a way of seeing creativity that focused on these great contributions to the sciences. But were women allowed to participate in the sciences? I mean, women weren't allowed to participate for the longest time in those domains where you could get a Nobel Prize, say, right? And so if you can't participate, then you can't be, quote, a genius, right? And women were also engaged in creative activities, but, you know, when mom comes home and the cupboard is almost empty and she has to feed the family somehow, and she manages to put something together, that requires creativity. But it's not what we consider creativity, right? It's not, well, you're going to get a Nobel Prize, mom. But it's creativity in different domains, right? And I mean, even today, I mean, Silicon Valley, right? It's there are all sorts of, I mean, there's hard evidence that women are kept out of a lot of positions, that it's very much of a brotopia, it's being called. And you know, physics departments still apparently quite unfriendly to women. Not all of them, but there's definitely that sense of, you know, this is the boys' club, and we don't let any girls in. So that also becomes then this whole field where you can just sort of immerse yourself and see all the different ramifications and how it's tied to larger issues of gender, but also cultural issues. I mean, it's fascinating. And at the same time, really, there wasn't very much on women and creativity. When I started looking in the 80s, that was also, there were a few articles, but it wasn't addressed in any real systematic way, or nobody was really looking at that creativity, that sort of that everyday creativity that I just mentioned. And so our concepts of creativity and the way that we think about it has been changing quite dramatically because it was surprisingly limited.
That kind of quotidian creativity, you know, the kind of banal but important, you know, day to day, those interventions that don't get recognized by whoever creates them. I'm not saying, you know, whether it's males or females. As we come to a close, and we've gone so far from diversity to, you know, to academic culture to gender to so many different aspects, and I knew in advance that we would, because, you know, your field of expertise and interest is so broad. If we always finish with the standard question, which is, if were you to have a magic wand and you could make changes in higher education which would foster cultures of creativity so that students and staffs, I suppose, inherent or innate creative capacity could be realized, what change or changes would you like to enact?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, what I've tried to do is say, well, what if we looked at education as a creative process? So reading an article, I mean, it could be just a boring article, but the truth is we're interpreting it. We're deciding whether it's boring or isn't boring, because it might have a great connection to something that we're doing. In other words, what would it mean then to start with the premise that it's a creative process, rather than think of creativity as an add-on or something lovely that occasionally happens? But what if we make it central, and not just in terms of having the great idea, but in terms of perception as potentially creative, and asking ourselves, well, what are we in fact creating? And very often we're creating things that actually trap us rather than freeing us, right? So I think that would be my not immediately practical, perhaps, but it's actually what we've tried to do with this, with the PhD program and the master's program. And it takes work to do that reframe. But I think gradually we're starting to see that if we look at that as central, it can make a difference in the way that we approach just about every aspect of the educational process.
So that we start off that basically that all outputs are in a specific domain have the characteristics of creativity, that they, you know, that they don't have to be game changers, but they all are part of a creative ecosystem.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, look, Alfonso Monturi, thank you so much for being a guest on our Crania podcast. It has been an absolute pleasure. Hopefully we will talk again, but I want to thank you very, very much, and we wish you all the best in the future.
Thank you very much. It's really been a pleasure. Thank you.